Life is 30% what happens to you, 70% how you react to it.
Welcome to the Health Science Coach Podcast. My name is Drew Garner, and I'm a health science and physical education teacher. This is a podcast to help students, parents, and recent graduates learn about pathways into healthcare and sports medicine careers. These industry professionals lay out how their experiences have helped them get to where they are now. If you enjoy this content, please subscribe to the channel or download through your podcast player. Thanks again for spending some time with us today. Now let's dig in.
Yeah, awesome. So, yeah, yep. I'm the head of real world evidence and behavioral science for the consumer healthcare division at Sanofi.
Okay.
And so basically within Sanofi, Sanofi itself is a very large pharmaceutical company, right? Awesome. We have, areas of rare diseases, oncology, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, vaccines is another big area for us. But we also have a consumer healthcare division arm. And so that's we own Allegra, Gold Bond, some of those kind of brands. And so those are more the brands that we oversee and that we're responsible for. It's sort of thought of as the self-care arm or the over-the-counter arm.
Okay.
So products that you don't need to go visit a doctor to see. And so we have the over-the-counter products, but then we also have products that we switch from prescription to over-the-counter. For example, Allegra at one point in time was a prescription, yep. And then it switched to over-the-counter. And so we also have some products like that that we work on where we bring them over-the-counter so that way there's more accessibility and everything to the population for those types of medicines.
Yeah. And so you've been there for 9 years and you kind of worked through the program or through your company, developing different things. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but currently, kind of give us what a week in the life of, or a day in the life of what your position does for Sanofi.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is there's no one typical day. I mean, every day is very different, comes with very unique challenges. I think that's also because, for example, real world evidence and behavioral science are, as scientific disciplines, they're very new fields.
Yeah.
And so very evolving landscapes, a lot of working with health authorities on working on adopting new evidence in new ways. And so again, with my position being, the head of the area, I work with a lot of my team on the various studies that they're running. The engagements that they have, et cetera. And so, luckily it's a lot of different engagements, but it's a lot of, problem solving, working through new challenges, trying to be innovative, so trying to find new ways to use evidence, new ways to, differentiate ourselves. So I think that's one of the things I like about the job too, is that, there's not really any one set schedule. It's all very dependent on what's in front of you. A lot of meetings, I will say that. Definitely a lot of meetings. So a lot of time spent on Zoom here talking to the camera, but comes with the territory. So
that's right. Yeah. So you studied your undergraduate at University of Iowa, and you earned your bachelor's of science in integrative physiology. Can you kind of describe what that degree is and how you kind of got interested in wanting to study that?
Yes. Yeah. Well, so originally I was going to go to medical school. And this degree pathway was a very big feeder into the medical school. And basically what the discipline focused on is, the physiology of your body, how your body moves, and looking at it in a connected way. And so it was a degree that had a lot of anatomy, just a lot of kind of that medical aspects of it.
Right.
That's kind of the reason why I went on that pathway. Cause when I was an undergrad, I was originally thinking I was going to go into medical school. And it wasn't until I think, second semester senior year that I realized that that's not what I wanted to do. So a little late to change your degree at that point.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is. So how did you choose Iowa? And what point did you kind of pivot, like you said, from, your senior year not going into med school? Where did that lead you to then next?
Again, I'm originally from Iowa. And so University of Iowa having a very strong school of medicine and everything, that was kind of natural choice. Plus, there's some academic scholarships, also never heard anyway.
Right.
But, I think, that's why they were kind of a natural choice for me to go there. And again, taking the classes and everything at Iowa, and I finally got to my senior year where I was going through the medical school applications. You know, I enjoyed the coursework. I enjoyed the science. I enjoyed that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But when I was actually going through the medical school applications, you know, I realized I didn't know if I actually wanted the doctor part of it. You know, so I was kind of stuck in this conundrum of, okay, well, I like the science, but I'm not a doctor. Like, I don't know what else is out there. I think, you know, like, what else can you be if you're not a doctor with this area? You know, I had a lot of background doing like some lab research, some bench lab research.
Okay. Yeah.
I knew that that wasn't going to be my experience, my field. I knew that that's not the field that I wanted to get into. And so, you know, honestly, that's really what ultimately led me to Boston.
Okay.
Was because I kind of found, you know, the area that I got my my master's degree in, which is policy and health management. And really, you know, at the time I was more looking at it as like the hospital management side. So, right. You know, if I did come, turn around, go back to be a doctor, you know, I could use this hospital management degree to, you know, run a department one day or, you know, do one of those things, et cetera. And so that's kind of what led me down, you know, this MPH route.
Right.
Really, because, you know, to be honest, when I was going into grad school and even largely today, there's not really an academic program for, you know, my field. And there is some that are coming through. It's called like healthcare services research, but right. There's still like, again, like I said, it's very in its infancy. And so there's only a handful of schools in the country that are really doing it. And so it's just kind of one of those niche areas that, you know, you kind of landed into, not really because I was seeking it out, but just because I knew what I liked. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I kind of said, well, I like doing this. Well, I don't like doing that. I like doing this. I don't like doing that. And eventually it kind of led me down this road.
Okay. So would you work with somebody that would be like a clinical laboratory scientist in your guys' field and departments?
So where my area works more is in medical. Okay. So we're considered part of medical. And so really what we do with real world evidence and behavioral science is, when you think about, you know, generating evidence, you have your traditional clinical trials.
Yeah.
And then you have all this evidence that you generate outside of the clinical trial. Well, we're responsible for all of that.
Okay.
So, you know, like, so for example, you're wearing a wearable.
Yep.
We design studies that track your wearable, track your activity data, track your sleep data. And what we can do is, you know, say, for example, you know, during allergy season, you know, say you're taking Allegra. We could help understand, you know, when are your symptoms coming, and being able to guide you, you know, just by even, for example, your wearable data to say, hey, you might be having symptoms come up. You should probably take an Allegra, you know, to help stave off those symptoms or minimize the impact. Like what my team does is generates a lot more of that type of evidence.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool just to be able to know. And I read an article a while back about a wearable detecting something like that with a nurse. I think it was something heart related issues. So that's pretty exciting that's coming to the smartwatches and wearables and devices like that. So how did you kind of choose to go to Boston for, you know, like you said, you're from Iowa, you went to Iowa and then made that big jump over to Boston. How did that kind of work out for you?
Well, obviously it worked out pretty well. I'm still there. So
there you go.
To be honest, it was random. I had never been to Boston. I didn't know anybody that lived in Boston. You know, like I said, I was still considering medical school at the time. And so to be honest with you, I really wanted to go somewhere new and different and try it out. And I always figured, you know what, if I don't like it, I can always come back and, you know, go down my normal path anyway. And also too, I was looking at, you know, Boston is really kind of a healthcare mecca. You know, you've got, you know, a lot of the top hospitals in the country are out here. Most of the pharmaceutical presence in the country is out here. And so it was just a good spot for it. You know, plus some of the schools out here and everything. And so, you know, got applied to Boston University, you know, got in and thought it would be a great opportunity to do something new and, you know, figured I'd jump on it.
Yeah, no, that really is kind of cool to, you know, like you said, do something new. And like you mentioned, if you don't like it, you always have that opportunity to just come back and go down the route that you thought you wanted to do to begin with. But taking that advantage of doing something like that is pretty amazing to be able to. And like you said, it worked out really well for you because you're still out there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's, you know, I know one of the things you're talking about is just one of the, you know, one of the things that, you know, one of the decisions you're happy that you made. And I think that's one of them, you know, really is you know, taking that chance and, you know, taking that risk just to say, hey, you know what, if, like you said, if it doesn't work out, that's fine. At least I took the chance, you know.
So upon graduating with your master's from Boston, you got a couple of different internships, the Children's Hospital at Boston, the Program for Patient Safety and Healthcare Consulting Intern. When you were doing those types of intern jobs or entry-level positions, what kind of takeaways did you kind of get from those that kind of helped you progress your pathway into where you are now?
Well, to be honest with you, because it's a very competitive scene out here academically in Boston, a lot of them were unpaid internships. So really what I was taking away was the experience. And, you know, just learning from people doing the job, because I think that's one thing you find out is very true is that, you know, it's one thing to learn everything in a nice, clean academic setting. And then it's another thing to learn how it actually operates and is in the real world. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of those early on opportunities were, you know, even opportunities that say, like, I knew I wasn't going to go in this field. You know what? I wanted to gain experience on it because, you know, like you said, you understand what you want to do, but also what you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was a lot of too, just trying to take advantage of as many opportunities as I could.
Yeah, no, I really like that kind of just learning from the real world experience and, you know, deciding if that was a route that you wanted to go. At some point, something along with those jobs sounded interesting to you to want to kind of dip your foot in there. But then getting that experience and knowing you wanted to kind of pivot or change a little bit. So you spent the last 9 years now at Sanofi. Let's kind of work through your progression and what you've learned along the way that helped you become where you are.
So I'm actually probably one of the unique people of our generation that I basically started at Sanofi right after graduate school.
Yeah.
And I've worked with them my whole career. Luckily, you know, they're a very large global pharmaceutical company, so I could operate in many different roles across the organization and get a lot of different types of experience from them. But again, there, you know, I really joined the company because at the time it was called Genzyme, and we specialized in rare diseases. And really the reason why I joined them is I was working at a consulting company that we worked on a rare disease project. And I really fell in love with rare diseases because they were very nuanced. They were very specific. I mean, it was almost a person by person basis that you got to know these people. And, you know, they were just so passionate. And so I really fell in love working on rare disease projects. Okay. And so that's what originally lured me into joining Genzyme or Sanofi now. And I worked over in the, and as you can kind of see with my background, I've kind of divided up my time in rare diseases and consumer healthcare. So kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, as you would. But that's why I originally joined. And when I joined, I was doing a lot more work looking at payer reimbursement for rare diseases. And if you know anything about the reimbursement system, rare diseases are the most expensive drugs in the world because they cost just as much money to make, but instead of spreading it over 100 million people, you're spreading it over 100 people.
Right.
And so two of the drugs actually that I was managing were in the top 10 most expensive drugs in the world at the time. And so generating this evidence to justify their reimbursement was very challenging, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, when you're talking about a drug that's upwards of, you know, $700,000, $1 million a year for the rest of the patient's life,
right.
you know, then you start getting into conversations of, well, how much is a life worth? You know, like you're talking $40 million, $50 million, you know, so like you have to generate evidence to justify some of these things. And so, again, it was one of those things that I really fell in love with it because it wasn't a cookie cutter job, right? You're not just doing the same things over and over again. It's always new challenges. And so really what I started falling in love with wasn't the negotiations necessarily. It was generating the evidence to justify it, to understand like, well, why do we have this medicine? Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of what led me down this real world evidence path. Because at that point, you know, the drug is already approved. The clinical trials are done.
Yeah.
All that you're generating is evidence out there in the real world to justify why this drug works. and why, you know, you should still be using it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I really started getting into a lot more of real world evidence and everything. And then I started drifting over to consumer healthcare because it's a very interesting field in that with all of our products in consumer healthcare, really the consumer is the physician, the payer, and the patient all in one, right? They're the decision maker. And so we need to generate evidence for consumers. And your everyday consumer, like if I start reading you phase 3 trial results, I'm going to see your eyes gloss over, like I'm going to lose you immediately. Yeah. But like, if I start talking to you about like, hey, guess what? You walked 300 steps more yesterday than you did today because you got a better night's sleep.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be more meaningful to you, right? And that's where our real world evidence comes in. And I really added on the behavioral science because you realize that there's so much unconscious decision making that we do that goes unrecognized on a daily basis, that once you start calling that out, it makes some of this evidence much more meaningful. Like you start realizing the impact that the evidence has because it's actually changing your behavior. It's actually changing your health. And so I guess that's kind of how I just, you know, navigated the course a little bit. It's a very roundabout path, but yeah. I think that's part of the beauty of it, right?
Yeah, I think so for sure. And I really like, you know, like you said, you, justifying the real world evidence about how much a life is worth and what kind of medications is really going to help this person live a better and healthy life. That's one of the things that I kind of preach in health class when I'm talking to my high school freshmen and sophomores is your health is the only thing that you're born with and that you die with. And so my job is to try to give you a roundabout general health talk, I guess, from the book, from my experiences about how to help you live a healthier life so you can continue living and doing the things you enjoy. And so I think where you're talking about the wearables and the real world experience, I think is really interesting about versus the, you know, the stage 3 research studies and publications, because those get very lengthy and kind of hard for general public to comprehend.
Exactly. And that's another thing that we really, you know, embrace with consumer healthcare is the most important person in your healthcare is you. You know, like it's not your physician. They're not with you every day when you're making those simple choices of what am I going to eat for dinner? Or am I going to go on this 15-minute walk or, you know, watch this next episode on Netflix, right? And like those simple decisions add up to being more important, you know, a lot of times than even large decisions that your doctor makes. Or, you know, and so really a lot of the things that we focus on is how can we, and people are already doing it, especially with the pandemic. Like we've seen rises in people being more conscious about their own health. Like I'm now aware every time I have a cough, because I'm like, oh crap, is that COVID? You know, like, whereas before I've got a cough, you know, I need to persist for about a week before I even notice it, right? But, you know, and we're even seeing rises in people Googling their own symptoms and stuff. We've seen in the past 2-3 years that that's gone up dramatically. Yeah. And so now for us, it's more about, you know, people want this information about their health and how can I improve our health? Now it's about how can we get them the right information? You know, because, you know, just getting information may not be enough. Getting them the right information is how you actually make the biggest impact and actually give the biggest benefit to the consumer.
Yeah, but like you said, kind of the experience of that person is looking out on WebMD or looking out on the internet. There's going to be 500 different answers to the one question about what happened to who, and by getting them the right information, like you mentioned, I think that's key. What do you find just really rewarding about your job?
Honestly. For me, it's the little victories, right? It's the, you know, the publications that we get or the studies that actually make an impact. You know, one of the big initiatives that I'm working on right now is I'm working with my team to try and work with global health authorities and regulatory authorities on using new evidence in new ways. Because, you know, I think even, you know, when I don't mean to badmouth the FDA here, but, you know, even our own health authorities, you know, they still look at evidence, you know, like we did back in the 70s, You know, mm-hmm. we look at clinical trials. Yes, we're opening our eyes a little bit more to electronic medical records, et cetera. But with this digital revolution that we're in, like, we've got a whole new data source open to us. And so, I mean, I think for me, I get excited about the new opportunities that are available. Right. I mean, you know, I think my team will tell you that too. I think it's exciting about the potential, you know, and the potential impact that we can have in leveraging this evidence the right way and improving, you know, the overall health and improving the health of the individual.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the questions that I kind of talk about is misconceptions. And as a pharmaceutical company, you know, you're developing all these different types of drugs and or over-the-counter medicines for people to use at home. What kind of misconceptions do you kind of feel that are out there that deal with, you know, public health and pharmaceuticals?
Well, I mean, obviously there's the drug pricing discussion that everybody loves. You know, and that's one that I was, you know, very actively involved with for a long time. There's a lot of misconceptions around that. You know, that's probably a whole other podcast for you, to be honest. But, you know, I think there's also this a lot of times. And again, you know, like I've said, I've only worked with one company my whole career, so I can really only, you know, speak to that experience. But, you know, sometimes with pharmaceutical companies, there's this sort of like evil empire thought, you know, that like, oh, they're just out for the bottom line, the bottom dollar, et cetera. You know, and it's really not the case, you know, because ultimately the way that our products are better is by giving better health to you. Right. And to the consumer. And so, you know, that's really our ultimate goal. And so, you know, I guess, you know, that's probably the biggest misconception that's out there just with like, you know, the pharmaceuticals and everything. But, you know, and even in academic worlds, right? Like people always joke around that, you know, if you're in academics and you come over to industry, like you came over to the dark side, you know? And so, you know, like you've got this evil empire sort of backdrop to us, but, you know, again, I would say that's probably it. I would say probably the other thing is that, you know, and maybe this is more relevant for the discussion today, but one thing that I found is that, you know, you don't always have to be the smartest person in the room. And it's a lot of it is the recognition that you're not, you know, and the self-awareness that, you know, I know my piece and I know kind of, you know, what I'm supposed to do, but I don't have to have the answer to everything. And I think that's something that, you know, especially coming out of like, you know, grad school or college or, you know, when you're first getting into your job, you kind of feel like that, you know, like you feel like, oh, I need to know everything. I need to have the answer for everything. Well, no, you don't. Right. And like, you're actually there to learn and to get more experience. And so, you know, I don't know. Let me find out is a very acceptable answer, you know.
And I've been hearing that kind of throughout a theme of different professionals. And, you know, that's why you're kind of there to be a part of the team and have your experience and your professional expertise in some sort of category. And if you don't know, you have a group of people that you're working with on your team and your company with you to help you along that pathway.
Exactly. I mean, I'll be the first one to tell you, like, and I say that this is a good job of recruiting, but, you know, I recruited a team underneath me and I think I'm the dumbest one of the bunch, you know?
That's pretty funny. But you obviously you're hiring the right type of people, the right type of people for that type of experience. Let's say we are this one wasn't on our list of topics, but I like this question more and more. If you are hiring somebody to work for, say, your company or your team, what is a person that kind of look a role or what's the perfect hiree kind of look like for you?
That's what I mean, is there is no one perfect, right? It's you want a diverse team, you know? And so like, for example, I've got, you know, three different real world evidence engagement leads around the world. One in North America, one in Europe, one in Brazil. Well, my Europe one has a PhD in statistics, very strong statistical background. My Brazilian one is a infectious disease physician. The one in North America, if I can get it released, is a PhD economist, right? And so there's no one perfect candidate or one ideal background. It's somebody that has the right background, the right experience, but also too, I mean, it's, you know, because you're going to get to a point where everybody has the right degrees, right? And the right, you know, job profiles. A lot of it too is a team culture fit. You want somebody that fits with your team well, because if you have a team that gets along great, guess what? It's going to be high performing. If you have a team that hates working together, doesn't want to go to each other with anything, you know, you're going to have issues, right? And so that was one of the biggest things that I focused on when I was recruiting my department is, you know, yes, not only trying to find the best people for the job, but the people with the right mentality, the right mindset, you know. And I always said, you know, I don't want somebody that's just looking to, you know, clock in for their 9 to 5. I want somebody that, you know, gets excited about what we're doing and, you know, gets passionate about it and, you know, really, you know, kind of has that same mindset that I have with it, you know. And if you can create a team like that, well, now you've created a culture, right? Yep. And then it's easy to have bring somebody else into that culture and they'll adopt it, right? And so, you know, even when you're going out and looking for jobs as like a job seeker, I think that's another big thing that you need to consider is it's not just about the, you know, like I say, the X's and O's, the, you know, what's the level, what's the salary, et cetera. It's what's the company like? What's the manager like? What's the culture like? These are all very important things, because otherwise, like at the end of the day, guess what? You're going to get a paycheck, or you're going to hate your job, you know? So.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it any better myself. The culture is big time hit on, you know, fitting in the right spot at the right time and being the right person for that position. As far as professional development goes, what type of professional development do you guys see as far as industry professionals and learning about the new infectious disease type stuff?
Yeah. So again, with us, like I said, you know, real world evidence and everything is it's a new discipline, right? And so it's evolving. And so again, we try to, you know, we really try to be at the leading edge, at the cutting edge of it. And so, you know, I really challenge my team to be innovators in their study designs and everything. But also part of that is working directly with industry groups around the globe and making sure that, you know, we're leading the decision, the thought making around how these types of research are done and how these types of activities are used and how this evidence is seen in the eyes of the regulatory authorities, the health authorities, et cetera. And so, you know, it's really about, like I said, challenging ourselves, you know, to be, you know, kind of innovative in that and to be, you know, some of the leaders in that, but also, you know, kind of like what you were saying too about, you know, being part of some of the, you know, international groups, you know, like the ISP or the ISPs, you know, some of the international societies that focus on this type of research. And also, you know, like we publish a lot of our research. So that way, you know, you get it out there that, you know, this is new research. This is some of the innovative stuff that we're doing. So, you know, it's a lot through publications as well as kind of establishing your credentials, credibility in the field, et cetera.
Yeah. So then with industry trends, I know, like we mentioned a little bit earlier, but COVID was one of them. There's certain infectious diseases that pop up throughout, you know, every 3, 4, 5 years, those kind of rare diseases. What are kind of the industry trends as far as pharmaceutical companies go with working on these new diseases you guys are finding?
Well, obviously, COVID was a special case in and of itself. I mean, that was kind of let's drop everything and deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was definitely kind of its own case, because, you know, we all really kind of pitched in together to make sure that, you know, like, for example, like our company, even though we weren't one of the early ones with the vaccine, because we're one of the largest suppliers of the flu vaccine, you know, we helped out with a lot of the supply chains and getting the COVID vaccine distributed, right? And so it was just kind of everybody pitching in and helping each other out with it. But in terms of, like, you know, other emerging diseases, you know, other, you know, even rare diseases, you know, to be honest, it's one of those things that each company kind of evaluates on their own. Okay. And that's a lot of times how, you know, pharmaceutical companies have their pipeline is, you know, either you unlock a new therapeutic area for a current medication that you have, or you unlock a new mechanism of action or something like that. You unlock a new medication and then you understand which diseases can you treat. And so you can honestly go at it from either way, depending on kind of where the discovery is.
Right.
But yeah, that's usually how a lot of the pipelines and everything like that fits into, which again, right there, another great healthcare science field.
Yeah, Yeah, learning more about them every day. Professionally, you know, you've been with your company almost 10 years now. And like you said, you've only had your one experience with that company as far as work-related goes. What's something that you're most proud of achieving so far in your professional career?
I mean, you know, there's a number of like just different successes that I could point to, like especially like working on some of the rare disease products where, you know, we got successful reimbursement. And at that level, like I said, you're almost on a person by person level where like when I got a drug launched in Australia, and I mean, I got personal cards written to me from patients in Australia who now got access to the therapy, you know, and so like things like that are really cool. But I mean, also too, you know, I think I am, like I said, you know, I think number one, just navigating, you know, the world of a large pharma for 10 years within the same company, I think in and of itself is pretty rare these days in doing. But also too, I think, you know, honestly, I think the thing I'm most proud of probably is, you know, at the beginning, when I graduated from grad school, I kind of set out professional goals for myself. And it's something I tell a lot of people to do, that it's a, you know, really good idea, you know, long-term professional goals. And, you know, this is something I even tell my team, is I tell them that when we sit down and we onboard, I say, well, what position do you want to retire in? Because yes, it's fine doing a short, a medium, long-term goals, but, you know, I always make the analogy, you never take off in a ship without a destination in mind, right? And so, yeah, the destination might change, sure. But think about it, what position do you want to retire in? And you know, that can kind of help build you towards, you know, what are you thinking? Where do you want to go? And so, you know, I've kind of always done that and had that mindset. And so, you know, when I started after grad school, I you know, set out some personal milestones for myself to hit, you know, professional wise and everything. And I think the thing I'm honestly most proud of is that, you know, I am accelerated on that path. I have not only hit those milestones, but I've actually, you know, been moving faster than that. I've been outpacing them. Yeah, and so I know that's kind of a selfish thing to be proud of, but I mean, it's, you know, it's something that, like, I set a goal for myself, and I've kind of been hitting it. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, overachieving is something to definitely be proud of as far as your professional level. So let's take that question and kind of push it out 10 years from now. Like you said, you want to have your goals and your long-term goals set for you when you started out of college. You've been in the industry now 10 years. Let's look at the next 10 years. What do you kind of see yourself doing professionally in the next 10 years?
Yeah, and I mean, that's the million-dollar question, as they say, right? And so, yeah. You know, I think, you know, I definitely see a path forward for myself, like within Sanofi. You know, they've been very good with me in terms of giving me growth opportunities, development opportunities, you know, eventually looking at, you know, moving into those executive roles. Yeah. And moving into more of an executive leadership position. You know, I think, you know, that's probably where I'd be focused. You know, but also too, you know, and this is one of the things I always say too, is, you know, it never hurts to keep an eye on the horizon, you know. I think, you know, if everybody always says, like, if you could have one superpower, what would it be? I would always say that mine would be to recognize every opportunity in front of me. Because if you just had like a star above an opportunity, like, it would be, you know, it'd be unheard of, like, what things you could do. Yeah. And so, you know, I would never say that, you know, yes, I have been with Sanofi here like 9-10 years. You know, it'd be great to be with them another 10 years, but, you know, I think there's also an opportunity where we can look around and say, well, you know, do we want to, you know, maybe pivot and get experience, you know, in another area, in another field? You know, I would never say never, right, to those opportunities. And that's, you know, kind of some advice I would give too, is, you know, always keep an open mind, because you never know. You know, I never in a million years, like, if you would have told me in college I'd be working for a pharmaceutical company, the guy would have laughed at you. You know, like, I'd be like, there's no way I'd ever work for a pharmaceutical company. Right. Like, I mean, I think you just got to keep an open mind.
Yeah, I like that. And by, you know, having a star above your opportunities kind of leads into the next question. If you did have stars above your opportunities, it'd be easy to make those jumps and be like, oh, I'm going to go do that, and I'm going to go do that, and I'm going to go do this. And you did kind of do a jump for something when you went to grad school in Boston, not knowing anybody there. And you had a kind of a safe fallback where you could come back to Iowa and do what you wanted to do. But along the way, have you had anything that you wish you could have gone back and changed or made different, or maybe a regret of not doing something?
I mean, there's always, I mean, anybody that tells you they don't have any regrets is either lying or they're Jesus. Like, I don't know. but yeah, I mean, there's always things that you look back on and you're like, man, you know, like I could have jumped on that opportunity, or I could have taken that route. But I don't know that I would say that I regret any of it. You know, I think, you know, every decision, like, you know, cause it's very rare, at least professionally, that it's really a wrong decision. Usually what you're choosing between is which is the better option, right?
Right.
And so, you know, like there, yes, don't get me wrong. There are times where, yes, there is a wrong decision to make. But a lot of times it's, you know, which is the better option for you? And right. So it's hard to play the guessing game, you know, where you look back and say, oh, should I have taken that job or should I have taken that opportunity? You know, and so, you know, I look back and I always say, like, well, you know, one day do I want to get back working in rare diseases? You know, potentially. Do I think I missed opportunities there? Like, you know, no, I don't think so, because I think, you know, no matter the opportunity that you took, you're gaining experience. You're gaining, you know, a perspective, you know. So I don't think there's any like, you know, golden ticket that I missed, you know, that I just kind of walked by on the street. But yeah, I mean, I think there's always, you know, did I weigh my options and did I choose the best option? Well, I don't know. But did I choose a good option? I think so.
Good. Yeah, I like that. So let's kind of look back at, you know, your educational advice. So let's say you are now a junior in high school and you are wanting to go down the path of where you are now, kind of studying rare diseases, you know, behavioral science, and kind of just that general like for science type stuff. What advice would you give yourself as a junior in high school to prepare yourself for a career in that field?
Well, I would say, you know, like, number one, you know, get experience, right? Like, yes, obviously getting good grades is important, but at the end of the day, getting good grades is only going to get you so far. You know, colleges, medical schools, grad schools, et cetera, they're looking for not just somebody that is, you know, smart with the books, but also can demonstrate that they're smart in the real world, you know, smart with their experiences. And so, you know, yes, you know, it's very important to get good grades, but it's also very important to get experience to surround that too, because as well, you know, like when you go in for interviews and when you go in for other things, they're not giving you a test. They're talking to you, right? And so they need to be able to relate to you and they need to be able to relate to your experiences as well. And so that would, I mean, like, again, if I'm going back to myself, like, you know, back in the day, like I was very focused on like, okay, yes, got to get good grades. Well, yes, you do, but I didn't realize how much value all the other experiences that I was doing, you know, the extracurricular activities, you know, those kind of things, like they weren't just a thing to do. There were ways to get other experiences that was actually a way to differentiate myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. By standing out and getting some real world experience. So
you know, I feel like I need like an MTV Real World logo behind me or something.
Real World, it's all you. So somebody in undergraduate that's, you know, maybe looking to put yourself as an undergraduate in these times, somebody that is getting that degree and wanting to go into public health and maybe wanting to study rare diseases, that is already in college. Let's look at, you know, that junior, senior in college. Where they're going down that pathway of determining what they want to do, kind of like when you pivoted from med school to working in your field. What advice would you have for that age group?
I would say, like, you know, number one, you know, keep your mind open. You know, I know everybody knows the old adage that like X percent of people graduate with the major they went in with, and it's a very low number, you know, but I mean, it is real. And I always thought of myself as like, oh, I'm not that person. Like, I know what I want. I want to be a doctor. Well, you know, things change, right? And like, and your priorities change. And, you know, the people that I see struggle are the ones that can't let that go. You know, they're the ones that like, oh no, I want to be this. And like, I've always wanted to be this. I need to be this. And they're the ones that honestly, a lot of times they don't figure it out until they're out there in the real world. And they're like, oh crap, this is what being an accountant is. I don't mean to pick on accountants, sorry. But, you know, like, so I guess that's the thing. You know, and be honest with yourself. Be honest with yourself as to what you like and what you don't like. Because, you know, in college, you're really exposed to the most different material that you're ever going to be in your life. You know, like you have different courses that you're taking. You know, be honest with what courses you like and also what courses you don't like, because that will help tell you, well, what type of job do I want?
Right. Yeah. I like those. And so then that kind of transitions to, you know, somebody that is getting ready to graduate, that is looking for a job. By looking at those classes you mentioned that of what they like, and it help them with their job decision of where they should kind of fit in. So somebody that is getting ready to graduate, how would you kind of take yourself through that if you're getting ready to re-graduate with your master's and starting to look for positions? What advice would you have for yourself?
I mean, I know everybody says it, but it's true. Network. I mean, you get jobs by networking, because everybody in grad school gets good grades. Like, everybody does well. You know, you need a foot in the door, really. And you need, you know, and honestly, you know, a great way to start networking is through your professors. I mean, this holds true in college as well. Like, and I wish this is maybe one thing, if I could have redone it, I would like to redo it, is it took me until grad school to realize what an asset your professors are, especially the good ones. And I mean, because they're there to help you. They want you to do well. It makes them look good, right?
Right.
So it wasn't until grad school that I really, you know, became friends with the professor and really started talking to him about the material. And not just like, hey, what's on the quiz, but like, okay, so if we're talking about this, what do you think about that? You know, and actually posing philosophical questions and having discussions with them. And I mean, and it's through this professor, like I ended up becoming a TA for him while I was in grad school. And he actually is the one that, you know, put my name in for this fellowship opportunity at Sanofi. Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, it was through this professor that I even got, you know, my current job, my current opportunity that I was with, you know. But again, you know, that's why I say, like, especially with grad school is very important to be networking, to be, you know, understanding, well, what does this job mean? Well, what does this job mean? Because, you know, like, you're going to find that some jobs aren't what you thought they were.
Pretty quickly. Exactly. And we can talk all day about that. So somebody gets a job. They're already working in their field for 3 to 6 months. They're in the industry. They're doing their thing. What advice do you have for that type of person? You know, as you're looking back at yourself, you know, 6 months into your first position with Sanofi, what advice would you have for yourself as far as what you should be doing, who you should be talking to, questions like that?
Just remember, like, especially at this point in your career, you should be learning every day. Like, every day you should come home at the end of the day and be like, wow, I learned this today. I didn't realize that. You know, because at this point, that's what you need to be doing to really build your career and build yourself is, and I mean, I still look at myself that, you know, I should be getting more experience every day and I should still be learning and growing every day, because otherwise, you know, you're going to stay stagnant. You're going to stay flat at where you are. And so, you know, I think if you come in with that mindset, but also, I guess, on the other side of that, I think another thing that's very, very helpful, especially early on in your career, is self-awareness, you know, and just understanding who you are, what your strengths are, but also what your weaknesses are.
Right.
And one of the biggest drawbacks I see with a lot of people, especially coming out of like Ivy League universities, like, you know, that interview with us, is they're not self-aware. You ask them, well, like, and this is a popular question I love asking people, and I got it from an old manager of mine, but it's like, why should I not hire you? And a lot of these Ivy League kids struggle with that question. Because they've been trained to only answer it the other way. They haven't been trained to understand, well, what are my limitations? What do I need to work on in this role? And so, I mean, I think that's also very important early on is, you know, you need to understand where your gaps are, because that's where you need to, you know, build upon. You know, every a weakness is only a weakness until you make it a strength, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I really, really like that question. Kind of gets you thinking about, you know, you don't know what you don't know, and it's okay to ask for help. And so that's a interesting, it'd be very interesting to hear how people react to that question as far as why I shouldn't hire you.
I've gotten some interesting responses.
Really good. A couple more questions here for you. This one is a two-part question. So this came off of our athletic trainer, and hers was, if you dislike feet, then being an athletic trainer is not for you. So she basically said, you know, you're around feet, taping ankles, looking at rolled ankles, that kind of stuff. If feet is something that bothers you, being an athletic trainer is not going to be the thing for you. So as far as your role, if you dislike blank, working in public health and with diseases is not going to be the right career path for you.
I mean, I would say specifically like for real world evidence and everything, like I would say, like if you don't like challenges, it's not for you, because, you know, and, like I said, it's a very new discipline. And so a lot of the time, some of the studies that we're designing and that we're doing, we're literally doing them for the first time, you know, in the country that they're in, for example. And so because of that, I always say, you know, like we're cutting the path through the jungle. Like everybody else is going to be able to drive through after us, but we have to cut the path. And that's the only way that you can be the leader, that you can be the innovator, right? Is you have to be the one that does that, that cuts that path. And so, I mean, and I was very upfront with everybody I recruit. I said, you know, this role is going to be a challenging role, but what, you know, the other side of the coin from a challenge is an opportunity. And so because of those challenges, there's a lot of big opportunities to make big changes and to make big impacts. Right. And so I would say that that's the thing, you know, it's definitely something that, like, you know, you're not going to come into work and, you know, sleep through to lunch and then, you know, come back and, you know, hang out by the water cooler till 3 and coast through the rest of the day. Right.
Right. No, that's really cool by, you know, having that real world look at what you're doing and what helps and what doesn't help is like you said, cutting the path for others to follow after you. And let's flip that on it and say, if you do like blank, then this is the right career path.
I'd say if you do like, and it's going to be similar, but I'm going to word it in another way so I can count it as a different answer, right? But I would say, you know, if you like questioning, you know, and you like, you know, kind of, because what we always talk about with real world evidence studies is, unlike clinical trials, is we call them fit for purpose, meaning they're designed to the research question that they're made for. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a lot of, you know, scientific questioning. You know, what type of study do we need for this research question? What type of population do we need to evaluate? What outcomes are meaningful to this population? You know, and in a perfect example that I give to that is, you know, and I don't mean to keep going back to allergy here, but like when we were just launching an allergy study, one of the things we talked about was impact on allergies, you know, from an adolescent's perspective.
Okay.
But what we talked about is it's not just from a caregiver, but also what is the impact on the teenager themselves? And there we talked about, okay, well, the standard studies, you know, measure, you know, school absences and things like that. We said, okay, well, that's not enough. Just because they missed school, was there a performance impact?
Right.
If they were an A student before, were they still an A student, or did that drop them down to a B? What were the social impacts, you know, that this, you know, kid had? Also, you know, extracurricular activities, sports, you know, other things. You know, because, you know, for teenagers, as you know, like some of those things are way more important than school, let's be honest. Right. You know, and so, yeah, you look at the performance because that's what the adults care about. But then you have to assess all these other things because those are more meaningful to the teenagers, right? And so it's one of those things where you kind of have to adapt your evidence to your audience.
I like that a lot. I think, yeah, I've dealt with allergies my whole life and allergic to trees and grass, and having a lawn mowing company and playing baseball was probably not the right connection, but that's what I did. And I dealt with the allergy symptoms and all that stuff, and I still battle with it. But, you know, some of those questions that you're asking is, I think they're really cool because of the impact on me. If I missed a game, or if I couldn't run as fast as I needed to, or if, you know, maybe I got a bloody nose and had to sit out for so much time. Those kind of questions and looking at them as a research side and standpoint, I think is really interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. And like we say, it's that, you know, it's that evidence that you're not going to get from a clinical trial, right?
Yep. Exactly. And then a couple more questions. Do you have a mantra or a quote that you kind of try to live your professional work life through?
I don't know if it's professional life. I would say it's, you know, my just real life in general. Yeah. And it's a quote that actually got told to me in high school, and it was after I had just been in like a bad car accident. But it's, life is 30% what happens to you, 70% how you react to it. And I mean, I think it is 100% true, right? Because there's a big component of your life that you can't control. Like, you can't control like where you were born, you know, who, like what race you are, you know, things like this. These are out of your control. But how you present yourself to the world and how you present yourself after a challenge, for example, or after a failure, for example, and even more importantly, after a success. You're like, everybody talks about dealing with failure, but there's a right way of dealing with success as well, you know, and keeping all of this in perspective is, you know, it kind of is that 70%, right? It's that, how are you dealing with everything around you, and how are you communicating that back to the world? I think, you know, it's something just very good to keep in mind. And, you know, I mean it, like I said, I mean it both ways. I mean it not just in terms of hard times and picking yourself up, but also, you know, good times, you know, and keeping yourself humble.
Keeping yourself in check. That hits it on the head, you know, by controlling what's around you, controlling yourself around the environment around you, is how you're able to control that 30% of you.
Yeah, exactly.
So if anybody's interested in integrative physiology, public health, and wants to contact you, do you have any information or places that you would recommend them doing some research or getting in contact with you through?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, I'm happy to share my email with you. You know, they can always reach out to me on LinkedIn as well.
Perfect.
You know, I'm happy to, you know, connect them. Like I said, there are different, you know, societies or, you know, educational points. I think it, you know, depends on, you know, where are you in your career, course of your training, you know, and exactly, yeah, I'm not going to send the same material to a grad student as a high school student, but, right. You know, but yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, feel free to reach out to me, you know, through email or through LinkedIn or one of those things, and, you know, happy to connect.
Perfect. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, Andrew.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks again, Drew. Happy to do it.
If you've made it this far into the episode, I want to thank you again for watching. Please subscribe, share, and comment below with any questions or comments you may have. If you're interested in more information about other professions within healthcare careers, please visit healthsciencecoach.com and talk to your school counselor or academic advisor. As always, stay happy, healthy, and live life with passion.